At the turn of the last century, the Ottoman Empire was a cosmopolitan sprawl of ethnicities and religions, stretching from Albania and Bulgaria all the way to Baghdad. Author Louis de Bernière has set his new novel, Birds Without Wings, in a remote Ottoman village that's almost a microcosm of the larger empire. Turks, Greeks, and Armenians live side by side in Eskabache. They speak Turkish, but they write it in Greek characters. Muslims sneak prayers to the town's Christian icons, and Christians murmur phrases from the Quran just in case. Then the tragedies that tear apart the empire also roll through the town. Louis de Bernière joins us now from Boston to talk about his new book. Welcome.
Thank you.
For those who may have read other works by you, the theme here may feel familiar. It's this portrait of an idyllic, incredibly diverse village, this jumble of religions and ethnic groups that accommodate each other in their daily life. I'm wondering what the appeal for you is in this.
Well, I'm not a metropolitan writer. I grew up in the countryside in a village in southern England of fairly diverse and often eccentric people. And so that's my natural environment, and it's the one I gravitate towards when I'm writing. There's something about the flavour of small-town life or village life, which I think is the same all over the world.
And what drew you to this period in this place, the dying Ottoman Empire?
Well, in many ways, the Ottoman Empire was a model society. It was a society in which tolerance was compulsory, if that doesn't sound paradoxical. The Ottomans sort of sat on everyone equally and made sure they didn't misbehave, and they were mostly happy just to collect the taxes. And I feel that this is something that's worth remembering at a time when so many different nations and religions are at each other's throats. When I was writing the book, I was mostly thinking about the disintegration of Yugoslavia, which used to be quite a model society. Again, different religions and nationalities, and Marshal Tito sat on all of them quite impartially. And it was apparently quite a pleasant country to live in. And then, of course, when Tito died, they fell to fratricide quite rapidly.
It sort of sounds like you're touting authoritarianism there.
Well, what I'm touting is I suppose a kind of benign authoritarianism. I believe in Western democracy. I wouldn't want to live in any other system. But you know, in good democracies, I think tolerance is compulsory, isn't it?
The ways these characters get on are fascinating. I mean, the co-religions here kind of appealing to, you know, hedging their bets. Each one prays to the other god, and they get on in fabulously intimate ways. Did you find this true in your research, or are you imagining an idealized relation here?
No, I mean, in the big cities like Smyrna, the communities actually did keep themselves separate. There was an Armenian quarter and a Jewish quarter and a Turkish quarter and a Christian quarter. But in the little places which were more remote or out in the countryside, you had the same families from these different origins living side by side for centuries, and their edges got blurred so that questions of identity became much more difficult to decide.
Can I ask you to read a short passage?
Yeah.
It's page 157. One of your characters is in a shoddy neighborhood of Istanbul, again, a bigger city here where there has been some separation of various groups. He is noticing the dogs.
The dogs themselves were tribal and had divided the city between them into small canine republics, devoting much of their energy to assaulting dogs that strayed in from foreign neighborhoods. This made it impossible for Christians to keep dogs as pets, since Christian house dogs were considered to be interlopers and were routinely set upon. Muslims, fond as they might be of the street dogs, never adopted them as household pets because the Quran declares them to be unclean, and hence their concern was only for the ones that lived in the streets, pleading for alms with their big brown eyes. So it was that the followers of Christ poisoned the freebooting Muslim dogs so that they could keep captive Christian ones. Situations analogous to this, involving humans rather than animals, but just as hard to explain, are not unknown to this day in the nearby region of the Balkans.
So I was laughing out loud at that point and thinking, how is it that I'm reading about serious religious ethnic strife here and you keep me laughing? What do you even call that style And how do you get away with that?
Well, it comes to me naturally, so I don't really know what the trick is. The thing is, I came across this information about dogs in an old travel book. And he told this story about how the Christians poisoned the Muslim dogs because the Muslim dogs kept attacking the dogs that they wanted to keep as pets. And I just thought there was something fabulously ironic about all of this, and I couldn't resist writing it.
So whose travelogue was this? Tell me about your research.
I think this was from a book called Clark's Travels. Clark was a clergyman who travelled through the whole region in the early 19th century and wrote it up very faithfully. He noticed all sorts of wonderful things, such as that the camels at the front of a camel train would get addicted to cigarettes because the guy on the donkey at the front would always be smoking, and the camel behind would be inhaling the smoke. And they got addicted, and so it would come to the point where the camels would refuse to move until they'd had a cigarette first.
So that's true. You've got your little true. Addicted camel in there.
That's absolutely true, yes. And a camel can smoke a cigarette by having it stuck in the fold of their nose.
One of our producers who's read a lot of your work found that this was one of the grimmer works you've done, that some of the others had a happier ending. And, I mean, the history, obviously, is what it is. But I'm wondering if dwelling on this period has made you, I don't know, more cynical or depressed about the people in place?
Not really, because although I'm a pessimist, I'm quite a happy one. If you're a pessimist, you never find anything too disappointing. And none of these characters in the book are wholly good or wholly bad. The point is that at different times and places, we are all goodies or baddies. And the one good thing, I suppose, that you could say comes out at the end of this novel is, well, the birth of the Turkish nation, which was a miracle considering what a mess the Ottoman Empire had been reduced to.
And I was amazed at how you describe, you have chapters talking about Mustafa Kemal, later known as Kemal Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish nation, if you will, and how early in his life he was seized with this notion of secularism as the solution for Turkish peoples.
Well, he came from Salonika, you know, Thessaloniki, which was quite a sophisticated city back then with people from terribly varied backgrounds. People often used to say that it was a city that didn't actually have a country because it had everybody in it. And there was a famous episode where he came across some howling dervishes. They were people who thought you could sort of access the divine by howling a lot. Mm-hmm. And they were sort of bashing their cymbals and howling at Salonika railway station. And he, I think that was the crucial point in his life with regard to religion. He just found it so embarrassing. It was something he wanted to leave behind.
So you're going to turn now back home to England? You're going to write about your own hometown?
I've been writing these stories about my village for some years now, and I've probably got enough for about half a book.
So will it be something of a memoir?
The village stories won't be, no. But I do intend to write my memoirs someday, but I'm just going to make sure they're not published until 50 years after I'm dead. Because otherwise I won't feel free to tell the truth.
About yourself or others?
Oh, both.
Louis de Bernier is the author of Birds Without Wings. He joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
To read an excerpt from the novel, go to our website, npr.org. Martha Wexler edits our program, Tracy Wall directs, and Walter Ray Watson produces it, with Devar Ardalan, Susan Stone, Petra Mayer, and Tina Tennyson. Our technical director is Neil Ellis. Audio engineers include Peter Alina, Sherry Marshevsky, and Kimberly Jones. The newscast producer is Diane Scholar, and I'm Jennifer Ludden. That's All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Tapes and transcripts are available. Call anytime, 877-NPR-TEXT, or go to our website, npr.org. You can also hear any story from today's show or previous shows online at npr.org. Just click on Archives.